Good evening. Welcome to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Monday. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Coming up in the second hour, Khadija Ali Coleman joins us, the creativity coach, the creative midwife. It's a new segment with Khadija. She is the co-host. The only co-host on the segment in this second hour. She's also founder of the Liberated Muse Arts Group. She's going to be talking about reaping the benefits of a healthy relationship, and there's going to be a guest that we're going to have on, relationship therapist Tariq Omari Walton. That's coming up in the second hour of the show. The segment used to be called Dual Inspiration. And I'm struggling with what's the new title, because I got a lot of stuff going on all at the same time. But she's going to be the host, the co-host with me of this new Living Unbound with Khadija Ali Coleman. Exactly. Thank you for that. All right. That's coming up in the second hour of the show. A little bit later in this first hour, we're going to talk about the perils of the nonprofit funding infrastructure in Baltimore, really embodied by this controversial decision by the Living Classrooms to effectively shut down the Pleasant View Daycare Center over in East Baltimore. It's the only daycare facility, I believe, that directly services public housing families in East Baltimore. We will talk about that with Adam Jackson and Davon Love of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. We'll also get some reporting on that, some background reporting from Mark Reuter of the Baltimore Brew. But before we get to the brothers of LBS, we'll go to Ellen G., one of the coordinators of the Baltimore Ceasefire Movement. Ellen, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Sean. Hey. Hi. Hey, sis. Hi.
How you doing?
I haven't seen you in so long. How you been?
I've been doing pretty good. I haven't seen you since Saturday night.
Right.
First of all, for those people who want to suggest that somehow the ceasefire weekend was a failure, or how, right, whatever type of word, adjective they, right, want to attach to it, we know that in the 72-hour period, well, let's be clear, not just in the 72-hour period, but for really since Monday night up, right, until Sunday, we lost two people. Two people died because of violence in the city. But beyond the unfortunate loss of life, obviously, the reality is that many people found services that they desperately needed, legal help, mental health help.
Absolutely.
And we spread love around the city. And it is an ongoing call to action, if you will, by groups in our city, and there's nothing that I would consider, there's no way that I would characterize what happened over this weekend and the weeks leading up to it as a failure in any way.
Yeah, I think that there's an understanding of what the goal was. So the goal was 72 hours, no murder. And also was to raise the vibration of the energy in Baltimore City, to spread love, to, like you mentioned, plug people into the resources, to create space for people to have conversation about things that they thought about people that weren't necessarily true. So doing outreach in Baltimore City helped to bridge a lot of communication gaps. It helped to show people that, you know, people in Baltimore City aren't just, they're not just thugs or working people or corner boys or nurses, like a human being.
Right. Ellen, stand by. Stand by 1 second, because we want to tighten up your phone line. What we're going to do is, you know, Davon and Adam are in the studio with me right now, and they were participating in the Baltimore ceasefire during the weekend. Y'all were basically marching for most of the night, from what I'm told.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you all thought it was important for your organization to specifically get involved. What did you take away from your involvement over the weekend of Baltimore ceasefire?
So our participation in the ceasefire was with Alpha Justice and the Job Opportunities Task Force, particularly Alpha Justice. What they did was that they brought human and social service workers along with lawyers to two different spots in Baltimore, one on the west side, one on the east side. And what we did is on Friday night, we were in the east side at Bel Air and Erdman, and we stayed out all night. And we had food available for people, free food. And we had lawyers, human social service workers. And the goal was to make sure that people could get their records expunged, and also to show them that they were community-based resources. And it wasn't like a DSS fair, which is typically what these things are. You know, here's all the packets of information for food stamps and, you know, welfare and whatnot. And we were trying to show communities that there are black people here in Baltimore that are working on your behalf that can assist you with, you know, changing your condition. So Friday we were at Bel Air and Urban, and then on Saturday we were at Frederick and Collins on the west side. And I think in the course of the time we were there, because we spent from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., so 12 hours each day. Wow. All the way up, you know, to the evening and early mornings, a lot of coffee.
Right.
You know, a lot of people came through to, you know, get their records expunged, just to be around us and be in community. And so I think about 170 people total were able to get their records expunged.
Wow.
And got serviced by the lawyers working there, and like dozens and dozens of other black folks who just were around, you know, talked to the human social service workers, you know, got connected to WIN Family Services, black nonprofit that works with families, black families in Baltimore. And so it was really powerful. And the thing is, you know, people can look at who's murdered and who's not, but I think Erica and Ellen would agree with me that it wasn't really just about murder.
Never.
It was about embracing anti-violence and also uplifting the spirit, and just like Ellen said, changing the vibration and lifting the vibrations of Baltimore. And I know for me personally, especially, I mean, if you were at Bel Air and Urban at midnight that Friday, like, it was electric, because everyone was just like, you know, we were talking about anti-violence and how in 24 hours there were no murders, and everyone was just so hype off of that, and like embracing the idea that that's not normal. Like, murder is not normal.
No.
And we should feel okay to express that we want to stop it, and that people who are saying that's not cool, like, we should look at them sideways, because it's not normal to embrace violence.
Right. Amen. Ellen, I know you heard most of that. The fact that 170 people got their records expunged just at that one location, number one, is incredible. And it's just a testament to the whole Baltimore ceasefire atmosphere and energy, number one. But number two, we have to also realize, like Adam said, 24 hours it went by and there were no homicides. And you had pointed out on several occasions that we have been averaging as a city, unfortunately, tragically, like a homicide every 19 and a half hours. But we actually went 40 some odd hours without a homicide. And
exactly.
Again, you know, from Wednesday night until Sunday early Monday morning, really, we had two homicides in the city. So that's something for us to look at as positive. But more importantly, it's about, like you said, raising the vibration of the city, right?
Yeah, so there were people who were coming together who under normal circumstances either wouldn't be collaborating,
right,
wouldn't be working together, weren't aware that they had the resources that they had available to them. And that in and of itself is a success, and that speaks to what we wanted to accomplish. Like, that was one of the goals. So you had people coming from East Baltimore to Edmondson and Wildwood Friday night for the Stop the Violence rally. And how often does that happen in Baltimore?
That's an accomplishment in and of itself, actually.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, the way that the city is segregated, and it was all love. Like, and at the height of the rally, like, there were probably about 45 people with ceasefire signs and other people that were there running up to cars and getting people to beat their horns, and created like a party on the corner, like, of Edmondson and Wildwood in the name of stopping the violence. And For people to try to downplay that or to minimize it and make it seem like that's not a big deal, I don't know. I don't want to say that I feel sorry for them, but I wish that they had the ability to see the vision and to see the glory of it the same way that we do, because it's a beautiful thing to witness.
Indeed. As a matter of fact, right now, I believe that there's a meeting taking place at Community Mediation Maryland on Greenmount.
That's where I am right now. Yeah, 3333 Greenmount Avenue. The meeting starts in about 15 minutes. We're going to recap ceasefire, get people's reactions to it in real time, unpack some things, figure out what we learned, talk about what we could do better, because there's always room for improvement, and think about what we want Baltimore to look like if there is a ceasefire, not if, but accomplishing a ceasefire 365. Like, what does Baltimore look like when ceasefire 365 is implemented? What do we want for ourselves? What do we want for our neighbors? What do we want for our community? And what do we want for our city?
Indeed, indeed. And obviously you're going to be talking about, you know, steps forward in this meeting on Greenmount. What is the next step? What is the official next step of the Baltimore ceasefire movement? Or is there an official? Because one of the things that you and Erica have been careful to do is not to to keep it in the hands of the people, quite frankly.
Yes.
And that has been a very important narrative along the way of this ceasefire movement.
So one of the things that in my mind that it's important for us to accomplish is connecting people with resources. So unfortunately, there's this separation in the city, and people believe that, you know, there aren't things that are available to them to help them to get to the next level, whatever that next level is for them. Ceasefire 365 is about elevating our institutions. It's about connecting people with resources that they need, educating people about the resources that are available to them, letting people know that we are, like, it is our goal for Baltimore City to put the neighbor back in neighborhood and to amplify the unity in the community. That's what we would love to see.
Ellen G. is one of the coordinators of the Baltimore Ceasefire Movement, director of the Evolution of Perspective. Sis, much respect to you. You know
Thank
how we
you.
Feel about you
yes.
in the work that you've done and the work that you continue to do. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you all
for having me, and I'll see you soon.
Okay.
All right.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. We just finished speaking to Ellen G, talking about the Baltimore ceasefire movement the weekend that just passed. In the studio with me are Adam Jackson and Davon Love of the Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, who participated, obviously, in Baltimore ceasefire. What Ellen just said, Adam and Davon, about institutions. That's at the heart of y'all's work, quite frankly. Institution building, and that was, I mean, that's the essence of what this, not just this movement, but really all the organic Black movements in this city right now are all about understanding that they're not coming to get us,
right?
And we got to get ourselves,
right?
And that's what that was all about, for real, right?
David? Right. I mean, I think one of the impacts that the system of racism and white supremacy has on our collective psyche is that it has the unfortunate effect of socializing Black people to think that ain't nobody doing nothing.
Right.
You know, and that's often the narrative that people carry with them, because, you know, it's not in, you know, mainstream media. You know, you don't see it in popular culture, you know, and so people just assume that Black folks aren't doing anything, and that most of their interaction with issues around improving the quality of life of Black people involve some external force coming in to fix us. That's what you get mostly on popular culture. And those are the images and representations you get even in local corporate media. And so I think a part of that means that, and that's why, you know, this show is so important, is to combat the negative stereotypes that have been projected onto us so that people can latch on and be a part of the things that are out there, right? Because I think it does a disservice to the community that narrative of our folks aren't doing anything, that narrative being out there, undermines the ability to build the institutions, to make them stronger, to solicit more resources, to make them more sustainable. And so for me, the ceasefire represents really an effort to elevate our consciousness, not even just around the issue of violence, but be able to elevate our consciousness to see that all of what we have in our communities and learn to celebrate that in a way that traditionally we aren't taught to celebrate.
The whole notion of nobody's doing anything becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy,
right?
You know, mm-hmm. And it's obviously, first of all, it's not true. But also it's a distraction more than anything else. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed and I'm encouraged more so than I've been in several months by seeing how many organizations came together mm-hmm. to, you know, deal with because I think it's an important statement to repeat that this wasn't just about nonviolence. This is about, I mean, this is about, this was us saying, look, we care about each other because mm-hmm. people were providing services, much needed services. Right. And that was at the essence of what this was really all about.
If I can make in addition, because I think that's a really important point, and I really attribute a lot of the success of this. If you think about those who have been leading this particular effort, you know, people like Ellen G and Erica Bridgeford, and then at the sites that Adam and I were at and that Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle was at, you know, at Erdman and Bel Air and Frederick and Collins, you know, you had Karen York, who's board president of Alpha Justice, Nicole Hansen, who's executive director of Alpha Justice. You know, one of the narratives that I think it's put out there is that there is this kind of patriarchal, top-down kind of leadership amongst the Black community. And for me, what this did was it demonstrates the leadership that exists in our communities that's not in the public mainstream, right? We got really strong sisters. And so the idea, for instance, like I had a conversation with Erica on Saturday night. And a part of what she was explaining was beautiful about it is, you know, they don't own the work or own the ceasefire effort. Right? This idea of diffuse leadership, right? I mean, having an operational structure, but having diffuse leadership creates a context where it facilitates that kind of collaboration, right? Where there wasn't the energy of who's in charge, who's the head person, who's going to get credit.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that wasn't the energy that was in it.
Wouldn't allow that energy to become a part of it.
Exactly. Yeah. And see, that's a credit to Baltimore, right? We as Baltimorians should be proud that we have the kind of leadership in our Black grassroots community such that that's the kind of effort that we can pull off. We got to be proud of it, and we have to build on it. We have to elevate that kind of leadership to be the leadership that folks emulate so that we can undermine the traditional forms of patriarchal leadership that have really created a circumstance where it's been about people wanting to be elevated as individuals as opposed to creating the environment that would bring folks together.
Amen. Adam?
So one thing I think is essential is, like, as you're talking about anti-violence in Baltimore, anti-violence strategies, you know, I think that one thing that Erica and Ellen proved to me is that we can have a conversation about anti-violence without it being anti-Black, without us focusing on Black people just being savages that are randomly killing each other and that it's just happening by happenstance.
That's a great point.
That we can also have an institutional frame and reference point in terms of talking about racism and white supremacy, but knowing the origins of where these things come from, and at the same time being able to hold our community accountable in a way that's positive. And I think what happens a lot of the time, especially not just in Baltimore, but around the country, because there are quote-unquote formal ceasefire programs that police departments have. And the distinction, I think, is that this is focusing on how do we build up community and invest in community, and how do we focus on the things that are causing the violence in the first place. And what happens is, in our conversations about violence, is that's complete opposite. It's like, well, we just need to get it together and no one's doing anything and no one cares. When in fact, if we understand racism appropriately, then we understand there's systemic disinvestment from our infrastructure, institutions, organizations, and leaders, and that's what causes the problem of us not being able to address these issues in our community. And I think Erica and Ellen in particular have just been really important to help me see that, because people were initially asking us, like, why are y'all involved in the ceasefire? Because, like, well, Black people shouldn't kill each other, and we can talk about that and figure out what's causing that and assist with that without it being Black people just, you know, we're just stupid. We don't understand how these things work. You know,
well, I think it's something you also alluded to about Black people, the imagery of Black people just being savages mm-hmm. and less than human, and that's why they do what they do.
Right.
One of the great benefits of the work that Ellen and Erica were doing in engaging people directly on the streets was you got to hear the narratives of young people who are looked upon as these quote unquote savages. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, because I've them, they're not savages. Right. They're not bloodthirsty. Right. They're not these wild animals that the mainstream culture and mainstream media wants to paint them as. Right. They are thinking people who know that what's going on in the city is not cool. Right. And as one of the young men said, it's effed up what we're doing. Mm-hmm. One of the young boys was like, let me have one of the posters. I'm going to put it on my wall so I can just look at it when I go to bed at night. Yeah. I mean, that's an insightful young man.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. So we were on the east side. Adam and I and a few others did a walk with some of the brothers from the Fruit of Islam, the Nation of Islam, and did a little walk. And one of the things that in talking to them about just kind of walking the community, telling people about the ceasefire effort, what was interesting, and one of the things they said was a lot of brothers were really receptive to the idea. Like a lot of people's initial thought was they was going to have a lot of pushback. But a lot of the brothers were really receptive to the idea. And with it, one of the things that it taught me, and this is something else that I talked to Erica about on Saturday night, was that, you know, most of what a lot of the folks that are engaged in violent crime, many of them don't have a lot of examples of outpourings of love to them.
Amen. Mm-hmm.
And as an organization that deals primarily with like the material condition of black people, policy and all that stuff, sometimes that can kind of get lost, right? Where it's like sometimes people just want to feel like people care about them. And a lot of times these are brothers and sisters who just don't have any evidence of that in their immediate surroundings.
Right.
And so this effort, I think, helped to elevate that. It helped to create that. And I think that's why people were so receptive. Because like, wow, you're going to spend all your time out here with us just so that we don't kill each other? You know, and I think that was something that was reflected in the conversation. And that really pushes back against what Adam just mentioned in terms of this narrative of black people being savages. Right. Because it's like if you understand the conditions that folks are coming from, I'm at a conversation with a sister who lived right down the street off of Frederick Avenue. And one of the things she was telling me was that, and we agreed on this, is that particularly a lot of the boys, they grow up, they go through maybe elementary school, and they don't get the kind of affection and affirmation that they need.
No.
By the time they get to middle school, the light in their eyes is out, you know, and that's what we're dealing with in terms of the folks that are committing violence. And she was real clear. I make sure to tell my son that he's loved and make sure he's loved so that he's not susceptible to that culture. But we need to start putting forward more of those narratives so that it puts the violence in its proper context so it doesn't contribute to this whole notion of black folks are just savages and that's why we kill each other.
Indeed, indeed. This is what we're going to do. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Mark Reuter of the Baltimore Brew as we move on to this issue with the nonprofit funding structure in Baltimore, embodied in this controversial decision by the Living Classrooms to effectively shut down the daycare center over on the east side, Pleasant View Daycare Center, one of the only ones, if not the only one, that directly services housing families, public housing families. We'll talk to Mark Reuter, then we'll also continue our conversation with Davon Love and Adam Jackson of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. You're listening to First Edition. Stay tuned. To First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. I'm in the studio with Davon Love and Adam Jackson, Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, moving the conversation into the nonprofit funding infrastructure in the city, which has been challenging and problematic for a lot of groups and individuals for decades, quite frankly. And for that conversation, we want to open up with Mark Reuter of the Baltimore Brew, who's going to give us some background reporting on this story connected to the Living Classrooms. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here, Sean.
Good to have you. So let's talk about how Living Classrooms, an organization that gets funding, millions of dollars worth of funding from the city, I believe, in city grants, was able to effectively shut down the Pleasant View Daycare Center, which is the only, I believe, the only daycare center, child care center that services public housing families in East Baltimore. Give us the background on that, Mark.
Well, yes, you're right. For the last 18 years, Pleasant View has been located on East Fayette Street, right near the post office. It's sort of a cornerstone of the Pleasant View public housing project,
right,
and was put there specifically by former Mayor Kurt Schmoke to help mothers in particular who were being required, as you recall, in the 1990s to either get job training, go back to school, and get jobs. And the idea was is they needed some child care support and a place that would be safe for their kids and where they could feel good about it. The city had a dozen of these programs back then, 20 years ago. By 2010, most of these programs had been eliminated. They had been run by the Housing Authority as cost-cutting measures, by and large. But in the case of Pleasant View, they decided to keep the program, to put it out to private competitive bidding. A black operator and his black partner, who were well-known in the city, got the contract in 2010 and have been running, by all accounts, a successful program since then. But something else changed around 2 years ago as part of the deal to get funding and to have this Under Armour UA house that is located also at Pleasant View, funded by Kevin Plank and operated by Living Classrooms. The Housing Authority gave this second building to Living Classrooms at what we found out, the Brew found out, was $1 a year rent. And they decided pretty much on their own that the daycare center really wasn't what the community needed, that it instead needed a Head Start program. And they decided that Head Start program, without any competitive bidding, was to be run by the YMCA. And so the last couple months, they basically told the daycare center, out you go. The daycare center tried to appeal to some of the people on the Baltimore, prominent people in City Hall, to get some redress and to at least try to find a compromise on this issue. And they lost out. And last Monday, a week ago, around 75 kids got booted out of the daycare center, from infants to 10-year-olds. And maybe eventually in a month and a half, there'll be a renovated building with a Head Start program, of which around a third of the kids would not qualify. So that's where it stands now.
Okay. So first of all, to make the details of the story clear, the Living Classroom was given the building for $1 a year rent. Is that what you said, Mark?
Yes, with the proviso that they would eventually buy the building, but that hasn't happened so far. So they got the ability to lease the daycare center, and they terminated the daycare center on July 30th.
This organization that has received millions of dollars in city grants got this sweetheart deal as a part of the operation moving to Under Armour, I guess, is if I'm following the story correctly.
Yes, that would be correct. And their argument is, well, we're going to have a much better program. We're going to have a better educational component. The YMCA is a very good program. Now, the problem with that, and what attracted me to the story, is I went over to the daycare center the day before it closed, and I talked to a dozen mothers. I talked to many people of the staff, and they had not been informed of this, and they were all very, very upset, just disheartened by all of this. They knew nothing about it. They thought it was very arbitrary. And Living Classrooms has just sort of apparently in the last few months, a few of their people will come trudging through the building while the kids are in daycare and take measurements and stuff and then just walk out. But they really felt, I believe it's fair to say, that it was like an alien army came in from outside and took over their daycare center, which they said to me independently, you know, they consider it part of their community. It's a thing that really works well and helps with kids. That all the politicians now, as you well know, are always saying how we have to help the kids and give them, you know, good places, safe places to be. And here's a place that under trying circumstances was doing well, run by people in the community. So, and now they're out.
And so these are 75 children who represent probably some of the who are part of families that are some of the neediest families, if you will, in the city, at least on the east side, being literally cast aside for the sake of progress, at least in the minds of Living Classroom, which is this educational organization that is very well funded and therefore very powerful in Baltimore,
that's
in the Baltimore
correct.
City community.
And a key factor that I also have written about and have gotten no response to, the member of the Board of Trustees of Living Classrooms is Jack Young, president of the City Council. And he has definitely played an instrumental role in giving Living Classrooms the okay on this and have not really taken any advocacy for the daycare center. And following his lead, as they do over on the east side, as you know, is the city councilman representing that, which is Robert Stokes. And he says that he thinks Living Classrooms will be a much better deal for the community. Jack Young is not talking at all.
So does Pleasant View Daycare Center, does the daycare center, the owners and operators, or the families that were serviced by this daycare center, do they have any recourse in this?
Well, they're still trying to get some recourse, and they've appealed informally to the city. There's been some community people who, you know, have feel that this is not the right thing to do. But as I wrote last Thursday in the third of my stories about this, there is kind of a whispering campaign going on, saying that the operator had financial problems and not to get involved. I've since found out there's a whispering campaign about yours truly that all sorts of things I have allegedly done in reporting this story. And that seems to be kind of the way this is being dealt with here instead of head on. And what's interesting, Sean, is that, and for listeners, the daycare center is a 16,000 square foot building built in 1999, built very nicely. It's a handsome building. The classrooms are really nice, and the place is very clean and it's very big. The daycare center people proposed to Living Classrooms, hey, can't we keep our daycare center there, and can't the Y have its Head Start program, and we you know, share the space or divide the space. And according to them, and Living Classrooms doesn't dispute this, that was just rejected right out of hand for no real reason to the owners and no real reason given to me, except that's not what they want to do.
Mark Reuter, veteran journalist for the Baltimore Brew. Mark, thank you for your time and your insight on this story and your reporting. Thank you. We appreciate it very much.
Well, I appreciate being on. Thank you, Sean.
You're welcome. Let's turn back to Davon Love and Adam Jackson, Leaves of a Beautiful Struggle. So you, Davon, you pulled my coat to this story in the first place.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I mean, what's fascinating to me is that, you know, when you think about the human social service sector, one of the biggest problems is that many of the entities that are in leadership in the human social service sector are white-led nonprofit organizations. And a lot of times what happens is that the kinds of programs that are led by folks that are from community are often characterized as being lesser quality, of not being up, you know, not being, you know, state of the art. And those are all code words that are often used to justify taking over programs to deal with young people. The other thing that's also important for your listeners to understand is that, you know, a lot of the kinds of programs that get offered, one of the biggest challenges is often outreach to community. And part of the reason for that is because oftentimes there is a program already set up in terms of what the so-called community needs, and then people come in and try to impose what they think the community needs on the community. And to me, this is just a quintessential example of that dynamic. You know, I mean, like, you know, the journalist that, you know, just said, like Mark just said, you know, the community was satisfied, right?
Everything was just fine. But then the larger nonprofit industrial complex comes in and says, no, it's actually not fine.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to make it fine.
Right.
The way we see it to be fine.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's the kind of thing that doesn't get nearly the publicity it should. I mean, because I think what Living Classrooms is doing is not unique to Living Classrooms, right? It's something that is emblematic of the larger human social service sector. And the important part, I think, to highlight is that, unfortunately, because of what we talked about in the last segment, this notion that Black people aren't doing anything, it creates this context where, unfortunately, a lot of the folks that have the ability to do something about it aren't able to push forward and then sometimes complicit in the ways in which organizations like Living Classrooms are able to take over programs like this and undermine the efforts of folks in community. And so it's just the other part that's also a travesty about it. What the folks were doing in that daycare center in East Baltimore is something that people need to be looking at as a model.
Of course.
But part of the problem is because it doesn't have kind of a fancy moniker, it doesn't have the kind of relationships that like a Living Classrooms would have. Not only are they not going to get all the kinds of money that a Living Classrooms gets, but people won't even take the time to look at the important work that was done in a community center, in a daycare center, where parents were satisfied with the product. And that's the thing that we really lose, is the ability to look at the things that work in our communities and scale them up and replicate them.
We've talked about these, we've discussed these stories so many times on the show. The narrative becomes redundant, but it's not redundant because we have to continue these conversations. Mm-hmm. We have to continue to shed light on these scenarios. But this is really, Adam, this to me is the embodiment, as Devon just alluded to, this is the embodiment of what is so wrong with the nonprofit funding structure, infrastructure in the city right now as it stands.
Exactly. I mean, part of the problem is that, you know, people see nonprofit work or people in the nonprofit sector, even the philanthropic sector, they see it as benign, charitable work. And the fact of the matter is it's an industry that people have used to profiteer off the suffering of Black people in Baltimore. And Baltimore is not unique in the sense of this being the case, but Baltimore is very unique in terms of how many, just to like sheer amount of nonprofit organizations and philanthropic institutions exist here and how those things operate. And so one of the things that we've been trying to do is interrupt that pattern with the youth fund that was recently approved by Baltimore City Council last year. And part of my work four or five months has been co-chairing a task force that would determine how that $12 million is the structure for that money. So like not just putting that money in the Family League or some other nonprofit, because what the city typically does with money like that for youth and young adults is that it gives it to the Family League of Baltimore, which is the city's local management board, which manages all the children and youth funds for Baltimore, which is about $25 million that it manages every year. And if you look at where the money goes, who is paid in the executive leadership of that organization, and just generally its accountability structure, it ain't to community, and most of the time it's people who are not of and from Baltimore, and you can also trace it back to most of the time white folks in the middle class who are using that as a way to line their pockets. And so what we've been trying to do is to advocate that $12 million from the youth fund go into a new intermediary organization that would manage it. And we've been working with Associated Black Charities Help us design that by putting it in an ordinance in city council in September. So we're going to be talking about that more as the fall comes up. But that's an example of something concrete, because we should be using public dollars to fund and support and give us the seed capital to create black institutions and community like that daycare center, so we can use that those models as a way to replicate, you know, different institutions around Baltimore that are led by us. But at the end of the day, this is an industry. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of these six-figure executive nonprofits don't want to mention that, that their salaries is dependent on black people suffering, and that they have to continue to do stuff like this, like displacing an entire daycare. Like, that's for children. Like, that's not even, like, what we do is political. We're talking about children being serviced by people in community, and they can't have a building to just do what they do. And that's the main problem. It's not just there. You can talk about the art sector. Like, black artists don't have buildings and infrastructure to manage their work. Black social workers a lot of times are frozen out of their industries because it's white folks and white-led institutions that are profiteering off of our suffering. And we should be figuring out how to interrupt that practice and pattern in Baltimore if we're trying to make changes.
So, and what I learned from you all is that maybe a few decades ago, the infrastructure was crafted in a different way, where black people, black entities, black organizations, institutions had more control. And that's something that you all are looking to return to.
Mm-hmm. Right. There was a period of time during the Johnson administration, and a lot of like political scientists will be familiar with this, where there were federal block grants that went directly to cities, and that oftentimes those programs, the monies went to neighborhood-based organizations. What happened under the Nixon administration is, instead of giving those federal block grants directly to cities, they gave them to states. And so what the states would do is they would absorb those dollars and they wouldn't trickle down to the actual community. What also happened in Baltimore is that there was a move away from neighborhood-based community organizations that would get funded by the city, and a move towards quasi-public entities, right? These kind of nonprofit organizations in the name of transparency. Mm-hmm. Because the fear was, if you're giving money directly into the hands of these folks in the community, they might spend it in ways that are problematic. It might not actually get to where it's supposed to go. So the idea was, if you make it a nonprofit structure, then it would avoid those issues. When in fact, the exact opposite has happened. It has created a new way of resources being siphoned off away from where the community is. And I think a big part of that, we talk about the system of racism and white supremacy, this characterization of black folks in neighborhoods not being able to take money and use it effectively. Like this assumption that because they're black in the neighborhoods, they're going to misspend it, when there's millions of dollars of wasteful spending in the philanthropic and nonprofit sector that goes towards subsidizing the livelihoods of, you know, typically white do-gooders. Moving back to a dynamic where community-based organizations that have mechanisms of accountability, the boards of directors being made up of people of and from the community instead of boards of directors made up of the corporate sector.
Let's be clear. I mean, to make it plain, these people have been stealing money from black people for decades, for generations. Mm-hmm. I mean, money, millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And inherent in that process is that the process is completely opaque, basically.
Exactly. Right. And if you even trace back the creation of large philanthropic institutions, they weren't created to improve the conditions of anyone. They were created as tax shelters for large corporations like Ford and other big philanthropic institutions. These are white people who were rich, who decided that they didn't want the U.S. federal government to take their profit, so they decided to put it in philanthropic organizations and nonprofits, protect it from taxation, and then use that as a method to support their political agendas. And so what you'll see is that it's not there's nonprofits right here, a business right here, and a philanthropic organization over there, and the Democratic Party over here. This is an ecosystem of institutions, organizations, and infrastructure that is orchestrating white supremacy and racism on black people's lives every day and hurting us and not allowing us to transform our own conditions.
With a smile.
Right. Exactly. With a smile. And that smile is important because it's the thing that makes people not understand that it's racism.
Exactly.
They would see this daycare as one bad circumstance.
Right.
As opposed to an example of a larger infrastructure that does that on purpose.
Hey, there's so many black people that have that story, that X nonprofit pushed me out. X nonprofit decided that we weren't relevant anymore and that they were going to take our funding away and they were going to get the funding instead. Like, there's so many black people who do work here that even though they still live here, they cannot live off of the work that they want to contribute to their people because there are white folks profiteering.
Facts. Let me take some phone calls real quick. Let me go to Doug Colbert, University of Maryland Law School, who was doing some expungement work over the weekend during the Baltimore ceasefire, but he also has a question about what we're talking about now. Professor Colbert, you're on First Edition. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Sean, and thank you to your guests. I've been listening since the beginning of the program, and I particularly want to thank the organizers of the ceasefire weekend. It was so impressive, Sean. And you really had to be there. I was there Friday. I didn't stay through the night, you know, but I stayed till midnight. And it was something that in the old days we used to call these things a happening because something was going on there, you know, and it was an organic event. It was something that was coming from community. It was something that you could feel the change that was taking place in a community among the people there. And, you know, I was doing some of the legal work along with a group of other lawyers, public defenders, and the people were just so, you know, so welcoming. It was almost like, you know, thank you for being here. And I think it is the start of a movement. I don't think it's anything like something that's just going to happen every now and then. There's something happening here in Baltimore that's going to lead to people in community reaping the benefits of community's hard work. And I think that's the biggest statement that I got out of it on Friday night. And I think the conversation that you're having right now really has so much to do with self-determination, has so much to do with community being able to know the needs of community. I mean, you have to be somewhat careful of this because in New York there were some people of color who were taking advantage of the money and they were not serving the interests of people. But by and large, it's community that has community's needs most in mind. And I just really hope that this work continues and programs like this one are the best way of learning what's happening in the non-white parts of Baltimore.
Doug Colbert, University of Maryland Law School. Thank you, Doug, for your time. We appreciate you calling in. Let's go to Diane next. Diane, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
I'm doing I'm fine, Sean. How you doing? Hi, Adam. Hi, Dayvon.
Hey, how you doing?
How y'all doing? I just want to commend y'all on the ceasefire. I saw Edison and Bel Air Road. I was coming back from out with my grandson that evening, and I just want to say I live up the street. I mean, down up the street from the daycare center.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when Kirk spoke and the former commissioner Dan Henson had that daycare center built. We had several daycare centers, and my problem is we have a daycare center over Latrobe that's empty, brand new, empty. Mm-hmm. It was closed under O'Malley. Why can't they allow that gentleman to move over there with the daycare from Pleasant View over to Latrobe? And that's another public housing. And it's right in the community. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Charles, I mean, Sean, I don't know why nobody else thought about this but me. All the people that got these education, you know, why can't they use that building right there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I can't understand, is it a conflict that you're sitting on a board and you're the president of the city council and then you have something to do with that daycare center that's been, you know, been closed like that, you know?
I think those are good questions.
You know, we fight, and the gentleman that did the article, he also came over here in Douglas because we had a protest the same day that they closed the daycare center on a Friday, you know, and I'll talk to you about that later on this week, Sean, because it's things that's happening in the public housing people don't even know. They think that what happened during Freddie Gray, everything is okay. It's not peaches and cream.
Understood. Diane, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Let's take one more call. Let's go to Brother Leo Burroughs in Bolton Hill. Brother Burroughs, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Good evening, Brother Sean Yoes and magnificent leaders of a beautiful struggle. How y'all guys doing?
How you doing, Mr. Burroughs?
Well, gentrification seems to be the order of the day. Living Classrooms Foundation, longtime exploiters of people, favored group in the city pantheon of false leadership. What do we do, guys? Do we hold city council public hearings? What is the fight back strategy here regarding Pleasant View? I heard what you said. I believe in what you're saying, but we need an orchestrated process by which we can mobilize people around fighting back and knowing how to fight back, and our reliance on you is great. What do you think we ought to do?
Thank you, Brother Burroughs. Go ahead, Brother.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's actually an organization, Change for Real, that's over there. It's a sister, Miss Catherine, who actually reached out to you to try to see if she would be able to call in. But they were a part of the organizers of the protests that Diane, the last caller, mentioned when the daycare closed. And so, you know, they're working on some kind of redress. They filed a formal complaint. And one of the reasons why, you know, I made it a point to, you know, put this on Sean's radar is it just needs more public awareness. You know, a lot of people just didn't know. And I think this will help give them the leverage to go and talk to both the city council president and Stokes, their council person, to put the kind of pressure they need to actually address this issue.
Is there an overarching move that could be made by, say, for instance, the mayor of Baltimore to try to correct a scenario like this? I mean, is that even plausible? I'm asking the question. I'm not trying to be unfair. I'm just asking the question.
I mean, plausibly, because it's the I forget which unit of the of housing.
This Department of Housing for Baltimore City, right?
HABC.
Yeah,
so
right.
HABC theoretically could put leverage on Lisbon Classrooms to say, let them stay in the building because they're the ones leasing the building to Living Classrooms. So theoretically, housing could put leverage and the mayor could instruct housing to put leverage to allow the daycare center to remain. So that's something else that I imagine Change for Real is already pursuing and something that LBS, you know, will be certain to try to make sure that that's on the mayor's radar.
Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, founders Adam Jackson and Davon Love. Brothers, always a pleasure, and thank you for your service as usual.
Yep, thanks for having us.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour, First Edition, Living Unbound with Khadijah Ali Coleman up next. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Thank you.